This B Podcast Network show is presented by IXL. Loved and trusted by more than 1 million teachers, IXL enhances your teaching and takes work off your plate so you can make an even bigger impact on your students. IXL delivers personalized learning across a comprehensive pre-K-12 curriculum, including math, language arts, science, and social studies, and helps you assess student performance through actionable, real-time insights. Strengthen daily instruction, close knowledge gaps quickly, and set every student up for success. Want to bring IXL to your school? Learn more at IXL.com/BE. That's IXL.com/BE. Welcome to the Cyberchops Podcast. I'm Jethro Jones, coming to you from Washington, founder of the B Podcast Network and author of the book School X and How to Be a Transformative Principal. I am a former principal at all levels of K-12 education.
Greetings, everyone. I'm Frederick Lane, an author, attorney, and educational consultant based in Brooklyn, New York. I'm the author of 10 books, including most recently Cybertraps for Educators 2.0, Raising Cyberethical Kids, and Cybertraps for Expecting Moms and Dads. Jethro and I have teamed up to bring timely, entertaining, and useful information to teachers, parents, and others about the risks arising from the use and misuse of digital devices.
Over the coming weeks and months, we'll be talking to some of the world's leading experts from the fields of education, parenting, sociology, cyber safety, and cybersecurity today. Join us as we look at what it takes to better navigate our increasingly high-tech world. For more information or to donate to our work, please visit centerforcyberethics.org.
The Cybertraps Podcast is a production of the Center for Cyberethics, a 501c3 independent nonpartisan educational institute dedicated to the study and promotion of cyberethics as a positive social force through research, curricular development, publishing and media, professional training, and public advocacy. Greetings there, Jethro.
Hey, Fred. Long time no see. So glad to be doing the show with you once again. We had a whole bunch of episodes where I was solo and I missed my partner. So welcome back.
It is good to be back. The clouds are parting and I think things will be a little smoother.
Oh, so. Excellent. Well,
yes, excellent indeed.
We've got a great guest on today. His name is John Spiegel. He has 25 years of experience running global networks and managing infrastructure. He's an industry pioneer in software-defined networking and software-defined WANs. John has spoken on the topic of network transformation at industry conferences such as Gartner, Interop, VMworld, Palo Alto Networks, Ignite, as well as executive roundtable discussions. He's also been a customer advisor to companies like VMware, Palo Alto Networks, and Cisco Systems. Disruptive startups have also leveraged John's knowledge to bring products to market, resulting in successful exits. He hosts a podcast called The Edge, where he discusses the role of CISO, Zero Trust, and explores the emerging SASE landscape. When not helping companies on their journey to modernize and secure their networks, John can be found cycling on the back roads of Oregon. And if you're lucky enough to see a video of one of his great answers in one of our audiograms, you'll see he's got like six bikes behind him, which is awesome. So, John, welcome. So glad to have you.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah,
John, you're inspiring me. I think I'm going to have to hang up my old marathon shoes behind me from now on.
Yeah. Hey, funny note about that. In Kodiak, where I was a principal for 3 years, it's an island in the Gulf of Alaska. There is a running coach whose kid would throw his shoes around the telephone pole. He'd tie them together and throw them around the telephone wire. And so there is this tree and telephone pole that were just covered in shoes from kids who had finished a season or whatever, mostly his son's own shoes. But, you know, those traditions do exist and they are real. So that's not what we're here to talk about, though, even though exercising is important and healthy. John, why don't you start by explaining what Zero Trust, SASE, and SSE is for our education, mostly education-focused listeners?
Yeah, this is an area that I probably spend most of my time working on now here at HPE. Put simply, Zero Trust flips your traditional security strategy on its head. In the past, our applications, the key data that we ran our businesses, our educational groups with, even the government, was hidden behind what I call the four walls of the corporate or a data center. So much like a castle. So we had these massive firewalls, security devices, and everything behind it was deemed to be trusted. And everything outside of it on the internet was untrusted. It's very similar. If you look at a firewall or an internet device that you might have at your home, maybe it's a Comcast device or DSL from another vendor. On one side, it's your home. Everything inside of that home, you trust it. It could be your TV, could be your kid's laptop, iPads, all of those things. You just trust those items. Everything outside of that, that's the world of the barbarians. It's where all the bad things happen. And that's how we ran cybersecurity for a very long time. Then things changed. The internet came around and started roaming around, left the data center. They became SaaS applications. And if you're in the education industry, it's likely like Google Docs and all the other Google items they have, or Seesaw is something my daughter uses, which is delivered as a SaaS service. Many items like that, they don't exist in the educational data center. They're outside, hosted by firms on the internet. And how you secure those is going to be very different than what you did in the past. Mm-hmm. On top of that, now people, they work from home, hybrid workforce. We saw during COVID the emergence of the school of one, if you want to call it that, or what we call the branch of one in the corporate world. Whereas, you know, these devices that, again, were behind the firewall in the schools were now at homes. How do you secure those items? What do you do with them? That has risen to this new strategy called Zero Trust, whereby we look at relationships between devices, applications, and try to get them down to a point where it's just the things that you actually need to get your job done. In the education space, it may be those applications or enablement tools like Zoom or Teams or things like that. Instead of seeing all of the applications that you might see in a data center or a school network, it's just those five or six applications. Nothing else, nothing more than that. So you're constantly looking at trust relationships. The simple way I put it is Zero Trust is much like when you have a ship, call it, I don't know, the Titanic, whereby you have watertight compartments, which the Titanic didn't have. And that's why it hit the iceberg and sunk. But in a ship, if you ever served in the Navy, my father served in the Coast Guard. He actually was stationed in Kodiak for a little while. Those ships have watertight compartments. When you go to an alert status, you close everything up. You sever off, you know, spots in the ship from other spots in the ship. So if they do get water in them, that's the only place it gets water in there. And that's one of the main differences with Zero Trust. It's looking at those trust relationships, and you only have access to the things that you need and nothing more.
So if I could, John, I mean, it seems to me like the bulkhead metaphor is really good for intrusion, right? If someone's trying to get into your system and exfiltrate data from places they shouldn't. I think one of the issues that K-12 institutions run into, though, is the poor handling of data by some of the vendors that you're dealing with. So when you're talking about providing that kind of security, it doesn't necessarily reach out into the broader world and make sure that it's protected if it's sitting on a server somewhere else.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, which leads me to the other two frameworks that were asked about, and that's SASE and SSE. SASE is this framework basically that brings together Zero Trust with networking, with security. Its two main pillars is network access in the form of what we call software-defined WAN. I won't get into it too deeply. The other side is this other framework called SSE, where I deal with a lot. SSE has certain components. Zero Trust is at its foundation, but it also has protections from the internet, which we call a secure web gateway. It has another pillar called remote access, called ZTNA, Zero Trust Network Access. And then the item that you're talking about, how do we secure these SaaS applications? That is called a CASB or a Cloud Security Access Broker, which actually will go into these SaaS services and then start to look at how do we treat that data. Should that data be secured in a way? Are the right settings available? even has mechanisms whereby we can look at how that data is transferred. If it's transferred through one of these SSE systems, we can apply data loss prevention techniques in a very simple way to understand, oh my gosh, this, you know, data has social security numbers, or maybe it, you know, we know what the nomenclature is for that school's ID system. So we can say, oh, that has, you know, 1,000 school ID systems in it, and start to take action on that. Should that data be transferred to a Dropbox? Probably not a good idea. Or is it, you know, going between a school administrator to another school administrator? That's an okay thing to do. At the core of all of these systems is identity. And that is really where the focus of security has to be going forward, because it's not enough to put it behind a firewall in a data center, these massive walls. We have to get down to the point where identity is the mechanism that we're leveraging to understand, should you have access, should you not have access?
I'm going to come at this from a slightly different angle, but one of the projects I'm working on is a book called The Rise of the Digital Mob. And it really is examining the impact of technology on our communications, particularly our political communications. And so one of the issues that gets raised by that, I think, is relevant to what you're talking about, which is the issue of online anonymity. Mm. And so it seems to, what I would infer from what you're saying is that this is another reason to take a hard look at the concept of anonymity online. You know, particularly from a cybersecurity perspective, you really do need to know who's coming in and out of your data.
Absolutely. I agree with you. I mean, there is a balance point between being anonymous and not being anonymous. But we do see it in the school setting. My son, who goes to school, he was bullied online, and it was not on your regular, it was on social media, obviously. You know, people take a bit different stance in how they talk with you, how they interact with you, if it's online and they're anonymous. They will say things that they would never say to you in person. And to your point, I think, you know, identity has to play a role in that. We have to get back to more of a civil society where what you say has to be very similar to saying it in person, because what I might say to you in a setting when we're in real life could be very different than on a political format or in a school format. And identity has to play a role in that. It's conscious in our human life. I mean, we're just mechanisms of, what, 250,000 years of evolution? And you can't just change that in a matter of two decades. It's just
Give or take, I think you're exactly right. No, look, and this is a little off topic, so I don't want to go too deeply into it, but the issue of anonymity, you know, I am trying to recognize that it's a power issue, right? So there are times when anonymity is a recourse, you know, to power. But I think now the table is flipped and anonymity has taken on its own power that gets abused.
Absolutely. I agree with you. I think one of the things that I see missing, and maybe we can touch on this a little bit, at least from my experience in school, is this thought of bringing them up as digital citizens. What are the responsibilities that you must have in this environment? It's very new. Let's just say that. Yeah. And what's coming at us is coming at us super fast. But I think that's a topic for education, is what are the rules of the road regarding these new mechanisms? And how do we learn them? And how do we teach them? How do we teach them about privacy? Mm-hmm. How do we teach them about, you know, phishing and some of these other cyber attacks that are going on out there? And you know, how do we treat them to be civil people in a public center that might be a social media?
That's a great question. Jethro, I mean, digital citizenship is a topic we have touched on many times.
Yeah, it really is. And it's something that the reason why we're having you on talking about these more advanced topics is because we want people to have a better understanding of what something like zero trust is and why you should pay attention to it and know what it is, and how the way that I was thinking about this as you were talking earlier, John, is that It's like having a badge swipe at each individual classroom door in the school. So you know who's going into each classroom rather than just saying, once you're in the classroom, everything's fine. And we know from bad things that have happened in schools that somebody can get into the school in a way that is not authorized and be in the school when they shouldn't be or where they shouldn't be. And that can then make it not safe for everybody else. And I think that like having everybody wear name badges is important, and being able to identify who people are and being able to say something as simple as, hey, what's your name? What are you doing here? And being able to ask those questions is good. I want to talk a little bit about the identity, because we're talking about a virtual space, and how do you ensure that someone is the right person when people can share passwords and things like that? What are the mechanisms in place to prevent that kind of stuff from happening?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, that comes back to how strong is your identity program. If it's based clearly just on identity and passwords, to your point, sharing passwords, sharing those identities becomes very prevalent. And as well, what is the complexity of the password? With Zero Trust in SSE, SASE, you need to go beyond that. You need to start to interrogate other items. What's the device that they're using to leverage that application, that system? Is it a school device? Is it a home device? Is it up to a certain standard? Because that is another area that we see lots of vulnerabilities around. If those devices are not maintained to a certain patch level or revelation OS level, that's an item. As well as where is it coming from? So if a device, you know, I'm in the Beaverton School District here. If the device is coming from this Beaverton area, it's probably, you know, reasonably certain to assume that that's legitimate. But if it's coming from North Korea or Texas, may not be so much. We may want to, you know, ask some other questions around that device. So that's a whole nother mechanism around it. The other area that to be aware of, and I don't know how well this plays into a school system, is MFA, being able to have multiple factors for that authentication. Certainly, you know, a student may not be possible, but for an administrator, a principal, somebody who, you know, has that access to the crown jewels of the school system, MFA is another area to play into it. So going beyond just the username and password is critical. Having a good identity system and being able to then to, you know, interrogate further depending on the type of access you're granting that person to that whatever resource or application. Another point I want to, you know, the card swipe analogy that you put out there, Zero Trust looks to go a little bit further than that. So instead of having a school where you have the ability to do a card swipes on every door, Zero Trust really looks to eliminate you even seeing the possibility of those doors. So if you have a school of 100 doors and that person only needs access to 10 of them, what Zero Trust looks to do is eliminate those other 90. So all they see are the 10 doors, and those are the only ones they get into. The reason for that is what happens is when an attacker, bad cyber actor breaks into a system, they start to leverage what we call lateral movement, which means they start to move around, or if we're using the school analogy, they can move around the school to see where the doors are available. And even if you might have a card swipe on there, they might be smart enough to break into that card swipe mechanism and start to open those doors. So those other 90 doors become vulnerabilities.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up, because I think that that's the other piece of this that people who aren't in the know may not even be thinking about. That there's, you know, if I could make it so you could only see that there are 10 classrooms in my school and you can't access anything else because you don't know that it exists, that's a much different approach than you could only go in the A wing of the high school. And so I'm glad that you brought that up. I think Fred was going to ask a question, but Fred, I do want to talk about student privacy and them using VPNs and things like that. So if you want to stay on this topic, let's stay on it. But if you want to move on, we can move on to that.
I think we can do both.
Oh, excellent.
So let's stick with this topic for a second. So yeah, absolutely. I think Jethro raises a great point, which is that, you know, schools are a perpetual testing ground for cybersecurity because of students. I mean, this is not a static situation. You've got X hundreds of people who are constantly testing what the parameters of your system are. They're at the heart of that. So, you know, how do you suggest that school districts cope with that? What are the best tools for kind of keeping the little rugrats from running amok in your system?
VPN, that's a technology I personally would like to see go away. Because what VPNs essentially do is they put your device on the network. I mean, it is clearly on the network. It's an extension of the network. There's nothing in between it. And that's one of the challenges that we're dealing with now that applications have moved outside of the data center. In the past, that was okay because you had a device, most likely it was a firewall, that was doing inspection of that traffic. But with VPNs, that's no longer the case because mm-hmm. maybe some of that traffic is routed back to the data center. Some of that traffic's inspected, but the majority of it, if it's going to Google, you know, pick your SaaS provider in the education space, is not being inspected. So that's where tools like SSE or frameworks like SSE come into play, primarily with this technology called Zero Trust Network Access, or ZTNA. Essentially, what it does is it routes the traffic to a central location that is local to the area to eliminate or reduce the penalty of latency. And that traffic can be inspected, even if it's SSL-based. We can break that. And approximately 80-85% of traffic on the internet today is encrypted. So that's one of the advantages of an SSE system is it can be that man in the middle, that sanctioned man in the middle, and start to break down that traffic. So you can start to see really what's going on and then apply policy. And that policy can be based on you get access to these applications, or it can even be inspecting the traffic that's destined for the internet. So what categories are you going to allow people to access? And that's very critical in a school environment. And yes, I've got a 16-year-old. I don't know how many security mechanisms I've gone through to make sure that he can only access what he accesses. And I'll tell you, it's really hard because he's gotten down to the point where he figured out that he could change his MAC address on his device mm-hmm. and rotate it to get around some of the security protections that I was putting in place to prevent him from getting to certain sites a teenager would want to go to. So,
you sound like a proud, frustrated father.
I think at the end of the day, I've raised a hacker and I wasn't attempting to do that. He just is naturally curious. And if there's something out there that he wants to go after, he'll spend a lot of time on going after that.
It has been an observation of mine since I've been writing in this area for a while that there are few people on earth more dedicated than a teenage boy who wants to get at something on the internet.
Yeah.
That's really, really impressive. So, John, if I can beg Jethro's forbearance here, let's pivot a little bit and let me just ask you this. It's clear from the recent invitations I've gotten for school districts and so forth that concerns about AI are exploding. This has just become such a hot topic, and people are grappling with understanding what it is to begin with and then what the implications are. I would think that someone who's dealing with cybersecurity would have some thoughts on that. So let me ask you a couple of different angles. So number one, what do you see as the biggest potential threats of AI to a security professional like yourself? And then the flip side, obviously, are there ways in which you might be utilizing it to strengthen the work that you do?
Oh, gosh. Let me start with the first one or the latter part of your question there.
Sure.
Are there benefits to AI for cybersecurity? Absolutely. Cybersecurity is a very complex field, and we have multiple tools that we're dealing with, and we're trying to basically fight the bad guy in real time. That's a hard thing for a human to do. So if there is a mechanism that can bring to light insights, start to comb through the data in real time and start to understand patterns, that is a benefit. So how will AI be used in cybersecurity? It's going to be very much like a chatbot that you will encounter on a website when you're trying to buy something, or if you're trying to, you know, change airline tickets. I recently did this with Alaska Airlines, where I knew I was sitting on the runway. I knew I wasn't going to make that next flight. So opened up the chatbot and we had a conversation. At the end of the day, it changed my flights. I was happy. But how is it going to be used in cybersecurity? It's going to essentially take away a lot of the complexity of the past where I had to know how to work with device A, B, and C and be an expert at all of these. What it's going to do is present the relevant information to me and then give me a list of decisions that I can make based on, you know, one, two, or three, high priority, low priority, or just ignore it. But those insights are going to pop up and it's going to give me the decision-making process. How that decision is executed, I might be able to leave that up to the AI, or I can send that off to a human. So yeah, AI is going to definitely make a difference in this battle. But how can it be abused? AI is only as good as the data that it's trained on. So If I'm nefarious, what I'm looking to do is get into that data and train it in a way that benefits me. So security around the data that AI is leveraging is absolutely critical. The second area is if I want to create an attack, it's going to be a lot easier using a format like a ChatGTP to start to understand, okay, I'm going against a VPN from vendor X. What are the major vulnerabilities based on its operating system that I can leverage? And how do I bring together, you know, the attack in multiple ways? In the past, that was hard to do. You had to do a lot of research and bring it all together and code it. What's difficult with tools like ChatGTP or whatever the follow-on is, I can just ask it, query it. It will spit out probably 80%, you know, the framework there, and then I'm left to do the 20% and customize it. That's a pretty easy thing to do. So it's going to go both ways, but we are definitely in interesting times.
Well, I think the thing that was fascinating for me is the implications for things like a phishing and spear phishing.
Certainly.
Where, you know, traditionally, we've relied on bad English, bad grammar, inaccuracies in spelling, things like that. And of course, the large language models are going to take that away. And everything will look smooth and perfect. And the background research to make the underlying pitch more credible is easier to do.
Yeah. Now it'll say, let's dive in, and that'll be our keyword. And anytime I read that, I know it's written by AI.
Well, we need some kind of linguistic watermark, do we not? We have to. That's one thing we've never really, in the 14 months that ChatGPT has really been active, nobody's really sat down and talked about that. So
that's good.
Yeah. Any thoughts from you on that, John?
Yeah, it's early days. It's very early days in our journey to AI, and we're going to learn a lot, but it's moving fast. It's everywhere. Every conference I've been to in the past 3 months, AI has been top of the charts for anyone talking about it, to the point even where Forrester, which is a analyst firm that tends to be very conservative about making predictions around new technologies, came out day one, starting their security risk conference in Washington, D.C., and it was all about AI. So we're at a watershed moment for sure.
I absolutely agree.
Yeah. I think for me, the other piece of the student privacy that I want to go back to is students have a right to privacy as well. And employees have a right to privacy as well. And so how do you balance the need for privacy and the need for security in a virtual environment, both for the employee perspective and for the student perspective?
I think it goes back to someone's always going to have access to all of these things. And that's most likely the IT administrator. So they have to be well-trained and understood that thou shalt not look at certain things. And that's a critical piece. I, you know, previously, Mike, I worked in a company where that that was violated. And it was the one time that I met with the FBI. I was the victim of it. But it's the one time I met with the FBI, and I never have to hope to have that thing ever happen to me again. But that insider threat is always prevalent, especially in an environment like an education system where you're probably going to be leveraging some of the students for IT. It's just the way it is. And that's a good thing in a lot of respects, because it gives them a leg up on their journey, their career, their future. They get access to some systems that hopefully they can, you know, go on and have a strong career in. So there's definitely a balance point between how you treat that.
And it's something where I don't think we have all the answers, and there's still a lot of questions about that. And, you know, a couple of thoughts for me on that is, you know, employees do have a right to privacy, but also they shouldn't be doing stuff that is not pertinent to their work on work devices. I had a friend reach out to me the other day, and he said, "Hey, I think I'm going to get my own personal device because I've always used my work computer for all my personal stuff." And I'm like, dude, that's crazy. Like, I couldn't even fathom it, because I haven't done that until I became I'm doing my own business. And so that's now I do. But before that, I always had my own computer because I didn't want my, you know, shopping history, my personal stuff on the district computers, because I thought there needed to be that separation. But a lot of people don't believe that is the case. And I think more people should believe that that's the case, but, you know, you shouldn't be bringing that stuff in. But then it gets a little more tricky with students, because they may not have access to these things except through their school devices. And so those can be tricky situations. And, you know, if we just dive into something specific, that if a student is struggling from a mental health crisis or something like that, and they're trying to find support for that in a way that is working for them, that they're, you know, trying to research and learn what they need to do to deal with the challenges they're facing, that information I think should still be private. But, you know, if we can track everything they're doing and see everything they're doing and everywhere they're going, then we're gonna be able to see that. And so then, does that mean that we intervene, or should we not intervene, or how do we know what the right thing to do is in those situations is kind of where I'm going with that. Any thoughts, John?
That's a hard question. In terms of the devices, I think there's a generational issue here, whereas some of us who are more seasoned understand that, you know, thou shalt not mix devices. So what I do in my home world, I mean, I have two computers that I use, a laptop for, you know, on the weekends and after hours, and a laptop for work. And I try not to mix them. But my kids, on the other hand, you know, they're leveraging their iPads for schoolwork. It's just the way they do it. And, you know, where my challenges come is the mobile devices, like the smartphone. That definitely is hard to mix. I'm not going to carry two smartphones everywhere I go. And try not to mix and match them. So I think where that needs to be looked at is, you know, and this is something still out there in terms of IT, is how do we deliver an agentless solution? So how do we deliver applications without, and with security, with the visibility on a device, you know, may not be ours. It may not be controlled by us. And how do we containerize that so it's leveraged in a way that doesn't leave a footprint on that device? There's no data on it, but yet they can get the work done that they need to do. You know, in terms of looking at data and understanding, is there a crisis within a person mentally and based on the websites they're looking at? I'm gonna kind of avoid that one.
Well, look, this is a hugely complicated area, obviously, and it's difficult for schools in particular because they're in loco parentis. They have their own security needs. So you do want to have student privacy, but if that student is then trying to, you know, figure out how to pose a threat to the school, the school obviously yeah. wants to know that. A possible solution down the road, and maybe not that far down the road, will be the ability of AI systems to evaluate these things without a human intervention and only reporting out if certain criteria are met that rise to a level of human intervention. I'll be curious to see if that's a direction in which things start to move.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I think you're onto something there. You know, given the level of data that's produced, AI systems eventually will be going there. And you know, there is going to be a moment where we have a coach, right? And that coach is based on what your needs are, what your goals are, what your objectives are. And it's going to kind of give you, I think Microsoft calls it a co-pilot. That's kind of the term they're using in marketing for all their applications. But I think it's a good term because we're going to have a co-pilot, and co-pilot is probably going to take it a little bit further. When you're using that device, they're going to be scraping the data and analyzing based on, you know, what websites you're going to, what applications you're leveraging, what social media you're viewing, and get down to the point where even on your body, you know, I wear an iWatch and it measures, it measures my heart rate. It can measure, you know, my blood oxidation levels. The technology there is going to get to the point where it can really understand it. And then on top of that as well, there's a lot of emerging technology around the brain. And so to your point, I think we're at a moment where what is personal and what is not personal. It's very possible there's a scenario within 10 to 15 years where if I'm at work, I'm required or incentive to wear a device that kind of measures my brainwaves to know whether or not I'm focused on work or not. And that may be enhancing me as well to do a better job and to provide me focus. But again, it goes back to the point is, you know, what is really me and personal to me, and what should my employer or even school be able to see or not see? So interesting times.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Hey, this was a great interview, John. Where would you like people to go to learn more about you and the work that you do?
Yeah, so really the best is to reach out on LinkedIn. I do a lot of posting there. I have some contrarian opinions on technology, so I call it stirred, not shaken opinions. As well, I do run a group called the SSC Forum, where we bring together practitioners of this Zero Trust, SASE, and SSC frameworks together and have conversations around how to apply that technology. And then finally, my podcast called The Edge, where we interview a lot of CISOs or influencers or even technology evangelists within the industry. So those are the three places.
Great. We'll have links to those in the show notes. So make sure you check those out at cybertraps.com. And thanks again, John, for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure, John. That wraps up this episode of the Cybertraps podcast. In the coming weeks, we'll continue our coverage of emerging trends in a variety of areas, including digital misconduct, cyber safety, cybersecurity, privacy, the challenges of high-tech parenting, and now, of course, artificial intelligence. Along the way, we'll talk to a growing collection of international experts who are helping us to understand the risks and the rewards of digital technology.
You can find the Cybertraps podcast on all of your favorite podcast apps. We hope that you will share the show with your friends and colleagues and reach out to us if you have guests, questions, or topic suggestions. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter or X, I'm at Jethro Jones and Fred is at Cybertraps. And if you're still listening, you must have loved this show. If that's the case, please leave us a 5-star rating and review in your podcast service. We appreciate having you with us and look forward to having you join us for our next episode.
Do you want to save time on prep work, increase student achievement for all of your students, reliably meet Tier 1 standards? You can do it all, but don't waste another minute. Head straight to IXL.com/B to learn how IXL's research-proven teaching and learning platform can help you achieve these goals. That's IXL.com/BE.